This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Driving may be one of the most cognitively complex things we do on an everyday basis, but when you're driving in familiar territory, it's easy to drive so unconsciously you're hardly paying attention to the road. But Tom Vanderbilt is paying attention to you. In his new book, Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us, Vanderbilt analyzes many aspects of driving behavior and traffic patterns that we take for granted. He's written about design, technology, science, and culture for Wired, Slate, and other publications. Tom Vanderbilt, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, in your book, Traffic, you've brought together a lot of research about every aspect of traffic, and it's things that you experience every day, but you don't think about in a systematic way. What led you to write the book?
I had a sort of strange moment, but I think that one that almost everyone can identify with. I was driving back to New York from New Jersey and was on a highway, and an orange sign came along warning, merge right 1 mile. And this is a two-lane road, so they're asking drivers to essentially, you know, get into one lane eventually at the merge point. And all my life I've been essentially what you might call an early merger. I was kind of a polite Midwestern type who got over as quickly as possible. I sort of didn't want to anger anyone and avoid the aggravation and not be one of those people that I really resented who tended to stay in that open lane all the way to the end. And I took a Zen approach and, oh, let's just sit back and relax. But one day I was just feeling particularly rushed or frustrated by the number of cars that continued to pass me. So I got out of my early merge situation and jumped back into that open lane, went all the way to the front, merged in. And I felt so guilty about the whole situation that I started looking into it. And in this kind of strange area of traffic engineering, which was a new thing to me, discovered that if the system were set up so that there really were no late or early mergers, everyone just went to that point and merged in turn, the system would process cars 15% faster. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but you know, on today's crowded roads where you know we're not building any more roads, we're looking for minor improvements, you know, this could be a huge effect on traffic. And one organization identified merging difficulties was the word they used as the thing that bothered them the most about driving. There's just something unpleasant about merging. And anyway, so I was forced to reconsider my whole notion of what I thought was the right thing to do. And I thought, well, what else about this kind of everyday activity might be, you know, different than I had thought?
So look, getting back to merging for a second, so you're saying that engineers say if we all merged at the same point, traffic would flow more swiftly?
Yes. If people were told exactly to not leave that lane that was closing until the very point when it actually did close, and then we did a kind of nice alternating merge, it would be faster. And another benefit would be the queue of vehicles stretching back from the construction site would be smaller. And the problem with those queues is that often you're coming along the highway at 75 miles an hour and suddenly there's a queue of stopped vehicles and you are really not expecting that. So that just another strange benefit by what they call this dynamic late merge system. And of course, people do have to still do the right thing at the merge point and allow the other person to do an alternating. You have to let one person in, then go. And the same sort of thing we do, you know, in our normal life, in getting onto an airplane or any situation where you're queuing.
Now, something else I experienced that I didn't realize everyone else experiences too, and it even has a name. The name is called the dilemma zone. What is the dilemma zone?
The dilemma zone is when you're approaching a traffic signal and the light turns yellow and you're in that sort of strange moment where you're not sure if you should stop or it may in fact be too late to stop. When they've installed red light cameras, for example, at intersections, which is, you know, something – intersections are quite dangerous. A lot of people are killed and injured at intersections, and one of the reasons is going through red lights. So responded by putting up red light cameras to try to get people to stop. But people then try to stop sooner than they might if they knew they weren't going to get the ticket, and that sort of leads to an increase in rear-end collisions, which some people argue is still a better outcome than the more dangerous side collision if someone is going through the red light. So just one of these little – moments on the road where we have to make decisions on the fly based on you know, kind of a lot of inexact information. We're not robots that can process, you know, distances and time and kind of this mechanistic way. So the Dilemma Zone is aptly named, I would say.
I'm always afraid in the Dilemma Zone that if I slam on my brakes, I'll get rear-ended. But if I speed up and try to go through, I not only risk a collision if the light turns green for the traffic going across the other end of the intersection, but I'm also afraid mm-hmm. I'm going to get a ticket. And I'm always preparing my explanation to the cop who I'm sure is going to stop me and say, well, officer, honestly, I thought that if I stopped, I would be in danger of getting into an accident. So I really thought I was being a good Samaritan by speeding up and going through the light. I always have that little speech prepared.
They've probably heard quite a few of those speeches.
Yes, you know. I bet. So is this something that engineers have tried to deal with in the traffic light, of timing it so that you have the maximum amount of warning before entering the Dilemma Zone?
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, sort of algorithms and experiments that have been done to sort of extend the Dilemma Zone. And I mean, some people argue that, you know, really we should be thinking about, where possible, just getting rid of traffic lights in general and replacing it with something like a roundabout, which is a scary word, I realize, to a lot of Americans. But if you think about a traffic light, you know, that...
Describe what a roundabout is.
We as Americans tend to get a little hung up on this old idea of the traffic circle, which was, the first one was in Columbus Circle in New York City, and it was kind of this big, and the Arc de Triomphe in Paris has this situation too, and there's a sort of a bad movie, European Vacation, National Lampoon, which shows Chevy Chase and family kind of stuck in this endless traffic circle until the night falls and he's babbling uncontrollably. But a modern roundabout is just, it tends to be no more than two lanes, and you know, you sort of go in and you, instead of an intersection, you have sort of a circle in the middle, and you kind of drive around, and then you exit at the little spoke coming off of the roundabout. And I mean, the reason they're safer than an intersection, which a lot of people don't want to you know, sort of challenges their notion, is that there's a number of what they call conflict points in an intersection, places where cars can physically hit another car or a pedestrian, and a standard four-way intersection, it's something like 32 of these points, but in a roundabout, it's cut to 16. There's just fewer chances to hit someone. You're not crossing streams of traffic in a way, and it eliminates the most dangerous move in a intersection, which is a left turn on the green, which I'm sure you've experienced. You do have to, you know, rely a bit more on your own wits and kind of navigate it, which, and there's an argument that that's what actually helps make it safer, is that you're kind of having to judge other cars rather than just letting the signs do all the work.
There's a lot of places that are putting cell phone laws into effect where either you can't use a cell phone in a car or you can only use a cell phone if you have an earpiece and you're not holding it. And I'm of two minds about this. Like, I know there's been plenty of times I've been crossing the street and looking at the driver in the oncoming car, or the driver coming out of the parking spot, and they're on the phone. They are not looking at me. They're barely looking at the road. I know they're completely distracted, and I'm not moving until they pass by. But I confess that I'll speak on the cell phone in my car, although I have an earpiece, so at least my hands are free. But I will dial when stopped at a red light. Like, what are the most dangerous parts of using a cell phone in the car?
Well, you know, and obviously I can't say that don't use a cell phone or you will crash, because we all know we've all done it and we've not crashed. So on the other hand, pilots are, in particular, are trained to, you know, sort of only use their radios for, you know, mission-critical kind of communication. During a landing, they're not calling their wife to see if they need to stop and get milk on the way home. You know, so that, just this idea that we don't often know how distracted, and this is another feedback issue, we sometimes don't even know how distracted we are when we're on the phone. We're sort of the worst judge of that. And I did an experiment in a driving simulator in Massachusetts in which I was read a number of statements and I had to kind of read back what had been said to me and, you know, standard psychological sort of stuff. And I had a wireless earpiece cell phone and I was driving on a highway, and lo and behold, I smacked into the back of a truck. And when you simulate a truck, of course, and when you go back and look at this, they have eye tracking software that follows where your eyes are looking, kind of pinpoint. when I was on the phone, my eyes were locked just into a laser beam focus on this truck. So, you know, by all intents and purposes, I was, quote unquote, my eyes were on the road, but my mind was clearly elsewhere. And this seems to be something that's emerging. Scientists have argued to me, you know, it's not about keeping your eyes on the road, it's keeping your mind on the road. And we would be amazed, I think, if any listeners have seen a sort of now famous video that shows a team of people in white T-shirts passing a basketball, and you're asked to count the number of passes that are made. And as this is going on, someone in a gorilla suit strolls right through the group, plain as day, and more than 50% of people do not see the gorilla, and I was one of those people. So it, you know, just sort of reminds you of vision and perception are sort of two different things going on, and we really, if you think about the complicated traffic environment and how many things we're trying to track, and then talking on a cell phone is a bit like counting those passes. It's, you might be having an intense conversation where you're trying to remember something or describe where something is to someone, and that just really uses a lot of what they call workload. It's hard for us to judge exactly how distracted we often are.
For your research on your book, Traffic, you went to a bunch of different countries to see what traffic patterns were like there and what the traffic problems were there. One of the countries you went to is the Netherlands, which is interesting to me in part because there's so many people who ride bikes there. And I know in Philadelphia, where I live, where the streets are very narrow, I often feel very nervous when I'm sharing a street with a bicycle, just because I often feel like there's really not enough room. There's not enough room for us comfortably to drive at the same time. And then, of course, a lot of bicyclists in the United States, with all due respect, don't obey the traffic rules. So sometimes a bicycle shows up where you least expect it. So how does the Netherlands deal with bicycle traffic?
It's a really interesting question, and it's so complicated that I really should write a bicycle sequel, I think. But, you know, the funny thing about the Netherlands is that it has something like 30-odd percent of people use the bike as their everyday means of transportation to work. And in cities, some cities, it's even higher in the Netherlands. And, you know, in the U.S., I think Portland has about a 3-5% statistics, and then Portland is the most bicycle-intensive U.S. city. The Netherlands is funny, though, because people really don't wear helmets very often. They have some of the lowest helmet-wearing rates in the world, yet it's also one of the most safest places to ride a bicycle in the world. And so you talk about narrow streets. You know, the Netherlands, you know, a place like Amsterdam, we're not talking, you know, large boulevards. We're talking about very tight urban streets, which have a lot of bikes and often, in some cases, not bike lanes per se. And so I really think there is something to just the Dutch drivers really have become familiar with the ins and outs of cyclists. And just by dint of seeing them so often have become used to just kind of almost a cultural acclimation. And of course, cycling is so universal in the Netherlands. You don't just see sort of people on, you know, in spandex and racing bikes. You know, it's mothers with, you know, toting three children and groceries in the front. And so maybe even in that way, it's just so much more a part of the culture that I think there's people just sort of look out for one another. And, you know, even in Portland, which is a very bicycle-friendly city, there have recently been some road rage cases, to use that phrase, in which bicyclists and cars have kind of gone after each other. These are ancient issues of just how to share the road, and you know, we think it might be a new phenomenon. But when the bike entered New York City in the 19th century, it was an incredibly controversial device. People who rode horses and carriages hated it; they thought it spooked the horses. Pedestrians didn't want it. Where do you put the bike? Is it in the road? Is it on the sidewalk? So, you know, these have been with us almost since we began to do anything but walk.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Vanderbilt. He's the author of the new book, Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. We all have these things that other drivers do that drive us crazy. What's yours? What drives you crazy about other drivers?
I have one that is just a weird thing about being in the left lane and someone behind me wants to pass. They're tailgating me, indicating that they want me to get over, so I dutifully get over and let them pass. And then they move in front of me and then don't maintain the speed they had, and then they end up going slower than I did. So I often find myself in these weird games of passing and being passed by the same driver, you know, sort of dozens of times. And this is what you do on a long, boring drive, I guess. You just sort of play these games with yourself. And that's my pet peeve. I'm sure everyone has their own. Do you have one by chance?
Let me think.
Type of driver? Or?
Well, while you're on the subject of that, it really annoys me when I'm basically going at or slightly above the speed limit. I'm in the left lane because I have to exit left in a couple of minutes. And then there's somebody right on my tail honking the horn, you know, and it's like, quiet down. You know, I'm here because I have to exit. I can't move. And I really can't go any faster, not only because I don't want to, but there's a car ahead of me. So just calm down.
Exactly. And if you sort of surveyed American public driver opinion, I mean, getting people out of the left lane who aren't going as fast as you is sort of one of the obsessions of the American driver, I think. And but it's complicated because, like you said, you might have to exit. You might want to try to get past a block of vehicles that you don't want to get right into that right lane. And someone's always going to want to go faster than you. So, you know, the left lane is reserved for faster traffic is not as clear-cut as it sounds. It's a kind of an ambiguous thing that, of course, leads to all sorts of aggravation out on the road.
Oh, here's another pet peeve of mine. The person who thinks that they're really saving a whole lot of time because they're on the highway and they're darting in and out of the left lane, the right lane. You know, they're moving ahead, and they're doing it really quickly too, and maybe not even signaling as they do it. And you have this great statistic in your book about how little time you save, how very little time you save through that kind of driving.
Exactly, both on the highway and even in cities, you know, where there's so many traffic lights, you find yourself being passed by someone and then just rejoining them at the next light. It's so random. And I think a good rule of thumb that's been proposed is the more congested a highway is, the less chance you have to gain by changing lanes. It's just, it's every lane is filled. There's kind of what they call an equilibrium. You're not really going to benefit. If this helps keep you awake and keeps you from, you know, if there's a benefit there, it's a good thing. But the moment you change into what you think is the faster lane, you're probably already slowing it down by adding to it, and you might force the person that you've cut in front of to slow down. So it's sort of chasing rainbows, if you will, and you know, we're fighting a losing battle, and the time saved is often very small compared to the added risk you're taking on just by making all these changes.
Well, Tom Vanderbilt, thanks so much for talking with us, and good travels on the road.
Thank you.
Tom Vanderbilt's new book is called Traffic.